In my opinion, a vast amount of unmitigated tosh, piffle, and utter drivel has been written about the enmity and antipathy which existed between the two polar explorers, Scott and Amundsen. Jealousy, hatred, deep, brooding resentment, sheer bloody-mindedness. Yes, all these emotions played their part in the intense hostility which existed between these two men, but what caused these feelings? Conventional canon has it that Scott's detestation of Amundsen was the direct result of the Norwegians cheating and entering into a race for the South Pole. Absolute balderdash. The whole can of worms was created by one event, and one event alone. A cricket match played at Cape Evans in Antarctica on September the 18th, 1911, between teams representing the respective polar expeditions of Captain Scott and Roald Amundsen. It was the ill feeling engendered by this match which caused all the subsequent virulence of passions and ultimately, in my view, the untimely death of Scott himself. Let us picture the scene in those inhospitable wastes of Antarctica. A hut. Scott's hut at Cape Evans. Scott's specially constructed hut with its scorebox, its balconies for home side and visitor's side, its separate entrances for gentlemen and players, and the broad sweep of its long room windows. And outside, on the snow, a hive of activity. Two ponies pulling a heavy roller. The unmistakable figure of Petty Officer Evans erecting a sight screen. Captain Oates in the nets bowling his distinctive leg breaks and googlies to Lieutenant Bowers. How curious, incidentally, and how felicitous that Oates should share the same Christian name initials as the celebrated Kent and England wicket-keeper, Mr. Leslie Ames. Let us not dwell on that matter, however. Let us direct our gaze to the broad expanse of snow, shining and white and pure, outside Scott's hut. Look. Do you see? Chief Stoker Lashley digging a popping crease, and Cecil Mears feeding the remnants of a matting wicket to his beloved huskies. All is ready for the historic match. But wait, not so hasty. Let us examine the circumstances which created this most significant event in the whole history of polar exploration. I have in my possession documentary evidence to prove beyond peradventure that Scott had known of Amundsen's intention to strike out for the South Pole for at least 1 year. Indeed, discussions and meetings had taken place between the two men at Nansen's home in Christiania. It was at the last of these meetings that Scott came up with a proposition that was as novel as it was daring. The two expeditions should set out for Antarctica, he suggested, but once there, they should play a cricket match. And the winners of this match would be the expedition which would strike out for the pole. Let us now concentrate our attentions on the game itself. Unfortunately, the scorebook is no longer extant. By an extreme and profoundly irritating stroke of fate, it was in the hip pocket of Captain Oates when he set off on his final and heroic last journey into the polar night and eternal oblivion. Would that he had only paused a second before opening the flap of that snowbound tent. Would that he had considered the full implications of his dramatic gesture. Had he done so, I am convinced that there is not the slightest doubt he would have handed over that precious scorebook to his companions and would thus have been accorded by posterity even greater warmth than he now holds in our affections. Oates was indeed a very gallant gentleman. But he was also damnably inconsiderate. Another sad gap in our knowledge of this match is caused by the absence of scorecards. We know from his diaries that Dr. Edward Bill Wilson illustrated in watercolor several of these cards, which were printed on the portable press specially shipped out to the Antarctic for this purpose. Indeed, the workings of this press had been a major and constant source of concern to Scott over the months of detailed planning he had made into the running of the expedition. He had, in fact, borrowed one of the scorecard printing presses from Lord's and in the winter of 1910 taken it to Arctic Norway for special ice trials. It had failed dismally, but with a stubbornness of spirit that was ultimately to prove his undoing, Scott refused to listen to advice and insisted on bringing to the Antarctica scorecard printing press that was known to be a failure in the extremely low temperatures prevailing in that inhospitable clime. Would that he had taken a press from Old Trafford. So, since we have no facts and figures about the match, we must rely on the diaries and letters of those who were present. We know, for example, from his diaries that Scott had been brooding with deep misgivings about the match for many months after the departure of the Terra Nova from England. He wrote, "Everything that could be done to ensure the success of our party has been done. We are a fine body of men, resolute in purpose, steadfast in spirit. Our equipment is the finest that could be devised. We have ponies, tractors, and dogs. We have men trained in every facet of the scientific skills. We have old polar hands who have experienced every one of the unimaginable hardships and terrors that Mother Nature will hurl at us. Yet one nagging doubt remains. Where is our off-spinner, and where is our second-change seamer?" Others, too, had their fears. Oates, writing to his mother in his typical graphic and unpunctuated style, said, "We are a pretty dismal lot. We are all willing, but where is the leadership? We have absolutely no experience of cricket in polar regions, yet Scott refuses point-blank to organize decent nets, and what infuriates me even more is that we have on board Terra Nova a biologist name of Lily. He's a fast bowler of rare old promise, yet Scott, with typical idiocy, refuses to allow him to join the shore party. Madness. Madness? Stubbornness? Or was Scott, by deliberately refusing the services of a man who was to become one of the greatest fast bowlers the summer game has ever known, showing manifestations of the propensity for self-destruction, which would later end with such tragic results? Even Bowers, loyal, uncomplaining, hard-working, gallant little birdie Bowers, had his misgivings. When he saw Amundsen and his team arrive at Cape Evans for the match, he wrote to his mother, "Scott is a topper. A better leader or tent companion one could not have. I can say unhesitatingly that he is one of the best, an absolute Saab. But when I look at the gear and the togs the Norwegians have brought for the match, I admit the old heart plummets right to the boots." Those words were prophetic indeed. The Norwegians' equipment was certainly impressive. Specially prepared wax for their skis and cricket bats, quick-release bindings for their cricket pads, extra-long, non-corrosive crampons for their cricket boots, and warm, comforting reindeer fur lining for their abdominal protectors. The Norwegians had done their homework. If that were not enough to cast a cloud over the minds of the English team, worse was to follow when a bitter dispute broke out between Scott and Amundsen over the use of dogs and horses. Scott had shipped out ponies especially for the pulling of the heavy roller. Amundsen refused point blank to allow that. He had brought his huskies, and he insisted that he be allowed to pull the heavy roller. The argument raged. Finally, it was agreed that trials should take place to test the relative merits of dog and pony. Let Scott's diaries speak for themselves. As he sat on the player's balcony of the hut at Cape Evans, watching the ponies pulling the heavy roller, he wrote, "It is pathetic to see the ponies floundering in the soft patches. Now and again they have to stop, and it is horrid to see them half engulfed in the snow, panting and heaving from the strain." Amundsen's huskies, however, when put to the test, simply skimmed over the surface of the snow, the heavy roller whirring gaily in their wake. Once more, the months of meticulous preparation had paid their dividends, for Amundsen had the previous winter spent 4 months with his dogs on the high, bleak snow plateaus of Telemark, training them to pull heavy roller and gang moa. Scott never forgave Amundsen for this public humiliation, especially as at the end of the day, together with Oates, Wilson, Bowers, and Edgar Evans, he was compelled to man-haul the heavy roller. Under those inauspicious circumstances, it was not unexpected that Scott lost the toss. Bill Wilson, his sturdy and steadfast confidant, tried hard to cheer him up, but he was inconsolable. "I fear the worst, Bill," he said. "I fear we are done for." How apt his misgivings seemed, as on the most perfect of wickets, the Norwegians totted up a score of major proportions. From the diary of Birdie Bowers, we know that he himself caught out Wisting from the bowling of Atkinson for 78. We know, too, how to Scott's fury, Gran, the British expedition's Norwegian umpire, turned down his LBW appeal against, chagrin of chagrin, his opposite skipper, Amundsen, who subsequently went on to score 175, although some historians maintain that his score was in fact 174, owing to Gran's failure to signal a short run. We do not know the exact Norwegian score, although I suspect it was nearer to 600 than 700. What we do know, however, is that as soon as Scott's 11 went into bat, they were stricken by the most appalling weather. Blizzards, gales, lashing hailstorms, and sub-zero temperatures turned the wicket into a real sticky dog. And in next to no time, Scott's side, finding Helmer Hansen virtually unplayable, were in dire straits at 78 for 8, with Oates, Rhett, Hurt, bad feet. It was at this moment that the ultimate tragedy struck. The weather closed in so badly that play was no longer possible. Day after day after day, the vile polar weather did its worst. And Scott wrote in his diary, "Dear God, this place is terrible. Worse by far than the Thursday of an old Trafford test." But worse was indeed to follow. In the negotiations that had taken place before the match, Scott had insisted that his expedition would be responsible for supplies. Reluctantly, Amundsen had agreed, but only on the condition that if supplies failed, Scott would forfeit the match. And horror of horrors, supplies did begin to run out. The special depot built on the long-leg boundary could not be reached owing to the severity of the weather, and stores in the hut began to run dangerously low. On the fourth day, the cucumber sandwiches ran out. By the fifth day, there was no egg and cress. And on the seventh day, the last of the maids of honor was consumed. With the tea urn dipstick no longer registering, Amundsen took action. He demanded that either Scott replenish the stores by making an immediate dash to the long-leg depot, or he would insist that the match be forfeited. With the ponies useless for such a task, Scott and his four companions set out to man-haul the sledge to the depot and its supplies of Swiss rolls, pilchard paste, and gentleman's relish. The journey there and back took 10 days. 10 days of the most appalling hardships and deprivations which Scott and his gallant band bore with a courage that was almost superhuman. But when they got back, Amundsen had gone, and he had claimed victory. The next Scott was to hear of him was when he reached the South Pole and there found the flag of Norway flying from Amundsen's gun and moor cricket bat. It was the ultimate humiliation. So there is the true story. For more than 5 decades, it has been hushed up for one reason, and one reason alone. The fact that Norway defeated England at cricket. And that, dear listener, just is not cricket.